Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Genesis chapter 31. I'm going to do the first 25 verses 1 through 25, and our topic this time is Jacob flees Laban. His uncle Laban had just been hoodooed by Jacob in the last part of Genesis 30, verses 25 through 43, when Jacob figured out how to contract for spotted and speckled goats and lambs from Laban, and then figured out how to produce a lot of spotted and speckled lambs and goats, so that was his pay, his wages, and so he took them out of Laban's flock, and he had gotten fairly wealthy over the 6 years of labor that he had done that. He had already spent 14 years working for free, or working for Rachel and Leah, I should say, but he didn't have any flocks of his own, but now in these 6 years, he had piled up a bundle, gotten wealthy, and we'll see here as we get to Genesis 31 that Laban's not happy about it. So chapter 31, verses 1 through 3, we begin. Now Jacob heard the words of Laban's sons, saying, Jacob has taken away all that was our father's, and from what belonged to our father, he has made all this wealth. Jacob saw the attitude of Laban, and behold, it was not friendly toward him as formerly. Then the Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers and to your relatives, and I will be with you. Now how did Jacob hear the words of Laban's sons? He either heard them directly, they might have come to him and said, you're stealing from our father. Most probably, though, it was secondhand, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown saying. The word had gotten around. The rumors had been started, the whisper campaign. Now you notice that Laban's sons are like typical socialist, leftist liberals. If somebody makes money, it's at the expense of me. And the reason I'm poor is because he's rich. Therefore, I want to take it from him. That is ultimately, essentially, what socialism is. God was not a socialist. He let people get wealthy if they didn't do things like inhale drugs that would hurt their wealth-making ability, if they treated their employees right, if they didn't abuse their bodies or their minds, if they were disciplined, if they worked hard. There's nothing wrong with producing wealth, folks. God was not a socialist. He is not a socialist. And Jacob was wealthy because he worked hard. He was diligent. He was clever. He was intelligent. His father, Isaac, and his father, Abraham, were also wealthy. They were not socialist. I've lived in a socialist country for 23 years, off and on, China. And what they learned over there in China is socialism sucks, because that country ain't socialist anymore. It's more like a corporate fascist-type country now, where the central government allocates the means of production into certain favored areas of the economy, namely those of the Communist Party controls, but they've freed the market in many other areas, and as a result, they've gotten very wealthy. And it's really ironic. I used to tell people in China, I'm in a socialist country and everybody talks like capitalists, and I come back to America, supposedly a capitalist country, and everybody talks like socialist. As the millennial morons in the colleges who don't know a supply from a demand curve, who don't know a debit from a credit, who go around and say, oh, socialism's wonderful, it's all free. Well, you're not going to find that kind of thinking in the Bible. Now, these sons of Laban said that Jacob has taken away all that was our father's. Now, of course, that was not literally true. They were probably exaggerating. All can mean a lot. In the scriptures, the word for all, both Greek and Hebrew. But whether they meant literally every dime, which of course they didn't mean, but they were saying that Jacob has stolen, he's a thief, he's stolen a lot of that was our father's, that's still a terrible attitude for Laban's sons to have. Now, in verse 2, Jacob sees the attitude of Laban. Now, Laban never said anything that we know about. Here's what John Gill says, quote, Laban, quote, said nothing to Jacob, nor charged him with robbing of him, or any false dealing with him, yet was uneasy at his growing prosperity. He put on sour looks and an envious countenance, sad and surly and lowering. I love that old-fashioned English. Anyway, it didn't take a prophet to know that Laban's upset with Jacob. So Jacob's feeling insecure now, I'm sure. So, at this time, Jacob's ready to leave, and God backed him up on that, because verse 3 says, the Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers. Canaan land, promised land. Now, of course, how the Lord did that, a dream, a vision, a bodily appearance, as a theophany, we don't know, but he spoke to Jacob and says, get out of here, get out of Syria, get out of Padan Aram, go back to the promised land. Now, the Lord often spoke to the patriarchs in times of crisis. For example, Abraham was childless for a long time, and so God appeared to him at that time in theophany, in the appearance of Jesus, probably, who appeared to him there at Hebron. How about Abraham on Mount Moriah when he was about to sacrifice Isaac? God appeared. Jacob at Bethel with angels ascending and descending on Jacob's ladder to Jacob as he slept at Bethel with his head on the stone. Lots of times, of course, Jacob was in a crisis situation at the time. He was being chased by Esau out of Beersheba. So this is something that we see a lot of visions in the Bible, but we got to realize that what we're reading is telescoped. We see the high points, but there was years and years and years that go by. There weren't any visions. So people had to live a normal life. They didn't rely on a vision every time they turned around. They didn't go to Elijah's list and find a prophet to tell them what's going to happen tomorrow in politics. They didn't do that. They had to pray and live by faith like most of us do. But God, in his gracious mercy, and when times are tough, he will have special visitations to help us. I've never had one of those, but I have had people come to me in times of crisis and give me advice and wisdom, and it's not a vision or anything, but it's a special boost when I need it. And I'm open to the fact that, hey, if I need a dream and I'm in bad shape, in a bad circumstance, I'm perfectly open to that. How about the apostles when they were in jail? I said, well, that's when the angel showed up. Or when Paul was trying to decide what to do as he was in Asia. Should I go to Europe or should I go to Bithynia? And then he had the Macedonian call, had a dream. The angel says, come on over here and witness. So this is what happened to Jacob. He's in trouble. The angel appears, or God appears to Jacob. Now this visitation, some people say, was probably in response to prayer, because Jacob has become somewhat more godly since the Jacob's ladder vision at Bethel. Now, to be honest with you, I haven't really seen that. I know everybody says that. Jacob learned from his mistakes. He started out being a terrible deceiver, and now he's more godly and he loves God. Maybe so. But it doesn't really stand out. It doesn't really hit me in the head that he was all that godly. But whether he was or not, God appeared to him in visions. And this is not the only one either, because there's another one. He's going to give him a vision about the speckled spotted sheep, as we'll see in just a minute. So we go down to verses 4 and 5 of Genesis 31. So Jacob sent and called Rachel and Leah to his flock in the field and said to them, I see your father's attitude, that it is not friendly toward me as formerly, but the God of my father has been with me. By the way, I didn't mean to say that. With me, God in the vision to Jacob said, I will be with you. That phrase, God is with you, is everywhere in the Old Testament. In previous audios, I listed out a long list of scriptures where God is with you. But basically, if you think about it, if God is with you, that means he's going to fight for you. And you don't really have anything to worry about if God is with you, because there's nobody going to fight against God. You know, that old expression, is God on your side? Well, if he is, your enemies are toast. Of course, unfortunately, some people claim that God is on their side, and he's not on their side. They're just claiming he is. But if he really is on your side, your enemies have had it. All right, going back to verse 4 here. As I said, Jacob has told Rachel and Leah that the God of my father, Yahweh, has been with Jacob all the time, all of his life, even while he's over there in exile in Haran. Now, Jacob called for Rachel and Leah. Rachel is listed first. And the NIV Study Bible says, because her name is listed first, some say she now has been given precedence over Leah. Well, I don't believe that. You've got to be careful with that type of reasoning. I know the evangelical feminists like to say that Priscilla led Aquila in that marriage because Priscilla's name is often listed first before Aquila. And it is several times. But there's a problem with that idea, because sometimes Aquila's name is listed first. In 1 Corinthians 16:19, the churches of Asia send you greetings, Aquila. And Priscilla sends you greetings. Aquila's listed first. So should we argue from that Aquila's head of the family? I wouldn't argue that. I would just say Aquila was listed first. Acts 18:2, where he found a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, who had recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla. Paul didn't say where he found a Jew named Priscilla, who had recently come from Pontus with her husband Aquila. He listed Aquila first. Are we going to say that therefore Aquila's the head of the household? Well, I know feminists wouldn't go along with that. So we've got to be careful about whose name comes first. Now, notice that Jacob consulted Rachel and Leah. Jameson Fossen Brown makes the apt comment that a good husband will consult his wife before making a major decision. That's absolutely true. I believe that husbands should take the lead in the family. They should not be wimps. They have to make the call sometimes when there's hard decisions to be made. But any husband that makes a major decision without consulting his wife, like a major purchase or something like that, or a job change or something that will affect that wife's life. Any husband that does that without discussing that with his wife is an absolute 100% certified moron. I know a couple, now divorced, Christian couple. The husband just went out and borrowed $40,000 and mortgaged his house without telling his wife. And of course, he couldn't pay off the mortgage. lost his house and lost his wife. I'll never forget that. And I told him, hey, you got to tell your wife about stuff like this. That's not right. But at any rate, Jacob was a good guy. He consulted Rachel and Leah. Now, no, but he did not consult Zilpah and Bilhah, the two concubines. Well, why? Because they were concubines, not wives, I suppose. Although, in my opinion, he might should have talked to them too, because after all, it affected their life too. But he didn't, or at least it's not mentioned that he did. Now, notice that Rachel and Leah were called to the flock in the field. Jacob didn't go to their tents. Rather, he called Rachel and Leah out to the field where he's pasturing the flocks. Now, why did he do that? Well, there are several reasons. One reason might be difficult to get one wife into the apartments of the other. I don't know what their customs were back then, but more probably it might have been to avoid being overheard by members of Laban's family. So he went away from the family compound there, went out to the field. Or it could be that there was a sheep shearing festival going on. They always had these big parties when they sheared the sheep, and it would be natural that Rachel and Leah would join in the festivities. I don't know why. I suspect he wanted privacy. He didn't want people to hear what he's talking about. And that's why he called Rachel and Leah out to the field. Now, notice that Jacob, in verse 5, saw Laban's attitude, mentioned that as a reason that he's getting ready to vamoose. And that just shows that circumstances often drive us to do what God wants us to do. It would be so nice if we could just say, okay, God, whatever you want, I'll do it. But let's face it, circumstances drive us a lot. Well, in fact, it drove Paul. When the door was closed, he mentioned closed doors. Now, that's not the only way the Apostle Paul was led by the Father. But let's face it, if the door's closed, you ain't going to witness there. You're not going to do that. Let's say I'm praying for, well, I got an example. I know somebody that's praying to get back with her former husband, who's not a Christian. She became radically saved after they got divorced, and now she wants to get back with him, but he's engaged to somebody else now. When she knows that when her former husband marries that new woman, that door's closed, and that ain't God's will for her to marry him anymore. That's just the way it is, folks. We are driven by circumstances, and nothing wrong with that, really. And Jacob was driven by circumstances here to do God's will, which was to get back to the promised land, because that's where the promises were to be fulfilled. The land, the offspring, and the blessings. That land was not in Haran, in Syria. It was in Canaan. And so God wants Jacob to get back to the promised land, and so he uses circumstances. Providentially, the circumstances is that Laban and his family and his sons are getting uppity towards Jacob. We go to Genesis 31, verses 6 through 9. You know that I have served your father with all my strength. Jacob is continuing to talk to Rachel and Leah. Yet your father has cheated me and changed my wages 10 times. However, God did not allow him to hurt me. See, Jacob, he's talking about God a lot now, Yahweh. If he spoke thus, the speckled shall be your wages, then all the flock brought forth speckled. And if he spoke thus, the striped shall be your wages, then all the flock brought forth striped. Thus God has taken away your father's livestock and given them to me. Now God gives all the credit for, Jacob gives all the credit to God for the increased wealth he got from the speckled and spotted sheep gambit that he pulled. But as I said in a previous audio, in my opinion, he was also using natural means, artificial selection, artificial breeding techniques to get these speckled and spotted sheep. And that's fine because we often use natural means, but we give God the credit for providentially taking care of us while we use our natural means. But anyway, Jacob is acting very submissive to the Lord here. Now, in verse 6, Jacob says, you know, Rachel and Leah, that I've served your father with all my strength. Jacob wanted Rachel and Leah to know that he was not running away from any obligation to Laban. He was not running away in cowardice. He was not breaking any contract. He was leaving, rather, in obedience to God, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown point out. And he says, I've served your father with all my strength. For 20 years he had done this. 7 years to get Leah, 7 years to get Rachel, and now 6 more years to get speckled and spotted sheep. Yet your father has cheated me and changed my wages 10 times. Well, the first time that he changed Jacob's wages is when Laban gave Jacob Leah instead of Rachel for his bride. When it was obvious that Jacob was contracting for Rachel, not Leah, he got hoodooed by Laban. That's changing his wages. And then the other 9 times must refer to the changing of the wages from speckled sheep to striped sheep, from striped sheep to spotted sheep, and so forth. The original deal was Jacob got to keep all sheep and goats, whether they were speckled, striped, or spotted. It didn't matter. But then Laban, as we'll see later, he changes all that and says, nah, this year it's only going to be striped sheep. And next year, oh, it's only going to be speckled sheep. But Jacob stayed ahead of that by breeding the proper type of sheep, and he got to keep them. Must have been very frustrating to Laban, but Laban was a cheat and avaricious fraud, he got what he deserved. Now, Jacob says that Laban has changed his wages 10 times. The NIV Study Bible and Adam Clark say that that's probably not meant to be taken literally. It probably just means completeness, as the NIV Study Bible says. In other words, Laban cheated Joseph at every turn. So when it is 10 times like an idiom, you cheated me 10 times, that means over and over and over again you cheat me. Now, later, Jacob repeats this charge about changing his wages in verse 41, which we'll get to in the next audio. Genesis 31:41. These 20 years I, Jacob, have been in your house, Laban. I served you 14 years for your two daughters and 6 years for your flock, and you changed my wages 10 times. Now, John Gill points out that makes it sound more like 10 times is a precise number. Well, whether it is or not, the point is the same. Laban is not a man of his word when it comes to contracting, and you never want to contract with people who don't honor their contracts. Now, in verse 9, Jacob says to Rachel and Leah, thus God has taken away your father's livestock and given them to me. See, he gives credit to God. He doesn't credit the striped rods and his sheep herding prowess. He credits God. Now, there's some options to how we can think this, see this. Option number one, Jacob could have felt that he used natural means, which is subordinate to God's supernatural means, and I tend to believe that. Or it could be that Jacob came to see that he had behaved superstitiously with those rods, the striped rods. He came to see that the rods had nothing to do with his wealth, but it was God that did it miraculously and supernaturally. And furthering that option, further supporting it, is that the rods only caused speckled and striped livestock to be born. But then when Laban changed the deal from solid to non-solid, he got more particular and said, no, this is the particular type of non-solid sheep that you're going to get this year, striped ones, or the particular type of non-solid sheep and goats that you're going to get this year, speckled ones. The striped rods had nothing to do with that distinction, and so you could argue that God is supernaturally making the distinction. But I say that, maybe Jacob could have used artificial breeding techniques that he knew that he had learned from his years as a shepherd. I don't know, but it doesn't really matter because no matter what we do naturally, God providentially superintends the whole process. You might work hard at your job, but God will supernaturally bless you and protect you from enemies in your corporation or in your job or enemies from your competitors or whatever. He will protect you from stuff, bad stuff, and he will bless you. That doesn't mean you don't use natural means, your ability, your smarts that God gave you, or your business ability that God gave you, or your social ability that God gave you, but he superintends over it all providentially. So Jacob gives honor to God here. We go to Genesis 31, verses 10 through 13. And it came about at the time when the flock were mating that I lifted up my eyes. Jacob is still talking to Rachel and Leah. And it came about at the time when the flock were mating that I lifted up my eyes and saw in a dream, and behold, the male goats which were mating were striped, speckled, and mottled. Then the angel of God said to me in the dream, Jacob, and I said, here I am. He said, lift up now your eyes and see that all the male goats which are mating are striped, speckled, and mottled, for I have seen all that Laban has been doing to you. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar, where you made a vow to me. Now arise, leave this land and return to the land of your birth. Now verse 10 says it came about at the time when the flock were mated that Jacob had this dream. Well, here's a couple of options as to what that time was. It could have been before Jacob's deal with Laban, and which would mean that this dream from God encouraged Jacob to do the deal. Or the dream could have occurred after Jacob's deal with Laban. This would mean that God has given his approval to what Jacob had already done. Well, whenever the dream occurred, it was while the flock were mating. Some say the flocks mated twice a year. Probably the mating occurred at the beginning of that last 6-year labor contract, after the 14 years for the two wives were up. In the dream, it was only goats in the dream. And again, if it's goats, but I think that applies to the sheep too. I don't think we need to distinguish goats from sheep here. The goats were striped, speckled, and mottled. The NIV has for mottled, spotted. So striped, speckled, and spotted. Speckled and spotted sounds like the same to me. Basically non-solid. Now, this does not mean that the actual goats in Laban's flock were necessarily that color. They were in the dream. John Gill assumes that the dream was before the deal with Laban, and so the dream was to tip Jacob off as to what sort of wages he should ask for from Laban when he made the deal. Now, that tip from the dream would help for the original contract, but again, later on, as the years go by, Laban changed the deal from striped, speckled, and mottled in general to striped in particular, or speckled in particular, or spotted in, or mottled in particular, and it's difficult to see how that dream would help him know which way to deal with Laban. So I don't think so. Gil says the dream could have tipped him off that way. Jacob could have seen which pattern in the dream. Yeah, maybe so. I don't think so. His, John Gill is interesting. He, amongst all my commentators, he is the one that's most often ready to see a miracle instead of providence working through natural means. You know, I guess it's a matter of taste, matter of personal predilection. But Gill's good at that. I tend to want to think that God works through providential means, and then it makes, when he does something miraculous, it makes it even more astounding that a miracle has occurred. If a miracle happens all the time, then after a while, miracles get to be commonplace. They get to be natural, not supernatural. But when a miracle happens extraordinarily, then it makes you take notice. This dream was conveyed, the information in this dream was conveyed to Jacob by an angel of God, and I presume that's Jesus. And whenever I see angel of God, I've gotten to the point where I'm convinced that that refers to Jesus. Not exactly a theophany, because the revelation was in a dream, not by an Jesus in human form in ordinary waking life. But Jesus is taking care of communicating with Jacob here at this crisis point. And he refers to himself as the God of Bethel. Notice the angel of the Lord referring to himself as, I'm the God of Bethel. That's Jesus referring to him as God, referring to himself as God. If that's the case, if that angel of God is the angel of God. And, you know, if you say it's a created angel, then how can you say in verse 13, the angel says, I am the God of Bethel? Because a created angel is not the God of Bethel. God of Bethel is Yahweh. Were you anointed a pillar? The angel of the Lord says. The pillar, of course, was, as we discussed, when Jacob was in Bethel. He made a stone pillar and anointed it with oil, which is what they did back then, to show that something big had happened there. A pillar was commonly used for worship in ancient times. All right, after Jacob's fine speech to his two wives, we go to verse 14 through verse 16. Rachel and Leah said to him, do we still have any portion or inheritance in our father's house? Are we not reckoned by him as foreigners? For he has sold us and has also entirely consumed our purchase price. Surely all the wealth which God has taken away from our father belongs to us and our children. Now then, do whatever God has said to you. Well, there's some buy-in. Rachel and Leah backed up Jacob to the hilt. It was clear that Laban had never given his daughters anything. He either kept it for himself or planned to give it to his sons. So Rachel and Leah are totally helpless. And they are going to cast their lot in with their husband, Jacob, to protect them. This is a great example of leaving and cleaving, folks. You leave your parents and you cling to your spouse. Now, what was Rachel and Leah referring to when they said that he, Laban, has sold us? Well, what he meant was, is that what they meant was that Laban had sold Rachel and Leah to Jacob in return for 14 years labor. Sounds like his daughters were slaves. They were talking like that. But remember, that was the practice back then. The husband bought a bride price, and then the wife went to the husband. There was reason for that, because a father needed to know that the husband could support his wives, and so he demanded a bride price. And you could look upon that as a sale. But that bride price was supposed to protect the daughters in case the husband then failed to provide for his wives, the father's daughters. Then the women would come back home to their father and the bride price would support them. That's the idea behind it. Well, I don't think Rachel and Leah had the idea that if Jacob finked out on them, that their father Laban would really take care of them. I mean, Jacob had given 14 years labor, but where was the financial reward from that was in Laban's pockets to protect Rachel and Leah in case they ended up having to go back to Laban? It's not there, apparently. Adam Clark says that Rachel and Leah well knew the true character of their father. So, Rachel and Leah wanted to leave Haran on their own accord, as well as they wanted to be submissive to their own husband. Two reasons. We now go to Genesis 31, verses 17 and 18. Then Jacob arose and put his children and his wives upon camels, and he drove away all his livestock and all his property which he had gathered, his acquired livestock, which he had gathered in Padan Aram, to go to the land of Canaan to his father Isaac, to the promised land. He arose, probably went from the fields where he was, and went to Laban's house to get his sons, John Gill says, his 12 sons, well, actually his 11 sons at that time, It's clear that Jacob went there because of what we read in the next verse, where Rachel stole her father's household gods. In order for her to steal the household gods, they had to be at Laban's house. Well, that's where Jacob arose and went to Laban's house. Pastoral people can strike the tents very fast. He packed up, went back to Laban's house. She stole the idols. He puts his children and his wives upon his camels, his two wives and his two concubines and his 11 kids, and they're ready to rumble. Now, the children at the time, Reuben was probably not much more than 12, John Gill speculates. Joseph, the youngest, was about 6. And, of course, Benjamin, the ultimate youngest son, wasn't born yet. Notice the mention of his acquired livestock, Jacob's acquired livestock. He drove away all of his livestock and all his property, which he had gathered, his acquired livestock. That's to show that he didn't steal it. That's why that little phrase was put in there by Moses. All the acquired livestock which he had gathered in Padan Aram, which is another name for Aram Naharim, Aram between the two rivers. Sometimes that's just translated as Mesopotamia, which is anachronistic because it wasn't called Mesopotamia until later. But Padan Aram, it literally means plain of Aram, Syria is what we call it, to go to the land of Canaan. We go to Genesis 31, verses 19 through 21. When Laban had gone to shear his flock, then Rachel stole the household idols that were her father's. So when they went back to the house, Laban was gone. He was out in the fields with his flock, and Rachel stole the household idols. We know that the flock was 3 days distant from Jacob's flock by a previous reference here in Genesis. Now, note that that might mean how long it took a sheep to travel 3 days, because a shepherd back then would travel with sheep. So it's a good long ways. Well, I should say it might not be as long as if you were talking about a single person walking 3 miles. That would be a long way. A person walking with sheep would be a little bit shorter, but whatever. Laban was away, and Rachel stole his household idols. Now, these idols obviously were portable because she carried them with her. If I remember the story, we'll see here shortly, when Laban catches up with Jacob, he's going to ask about those idols, and she's going to be sitting on the camel, won't get off because she says, "I'm having my period. Leave me alone." Now, Rachel's she's quite a woman. I think that's a neat story. Now, what were her motives for stealing her father's idols? First thing that comes to my mind, option number one, is to get even with her father. She's angry with him for cheating her husband, Jacob. Depending on how you read the story, she was deprived of connubial affection from Jacob for at least 7 years, maybe even 14, depends on how you read it. So she had to be in a platonic relationship with the man she loved and was going to marry. And so she might have been ticked off by that. So that might be why she stole her father's idols. Option number two, she might have wanted those idols for protection and blessing. But you say Rachel's a godly woman. Well, not necessarily. Rachel and Jacob's family was not free from their idolatrous environment. We read in Genesis 35:2, so Jacob said to his household and to all who were with him, "Put away the foreign gods which are among you." This is the household that was leaving Haran. And he says, "Put away the foreign gods which are among you, and purify yourselves and change your garments." So there was a little problem with idolatry amongst the flock of God there. And Rachel could have still been an idolatrist. At the same time, she's worshiping Yahweh. Third option as to why she stole the idols, it could be so that Laban could not use those idols to divine where his daughters had fled. John Gill says, well, that's giving a lot of power to idols if you ask me. I don't believe that option. Option number four, maybe Rachel wanted to relieve her father of his idolatry so her father would know the true God. Well, that's a wild one. John Gill is capable of coming up with wild speculations. I don't believe that Rachel would give a hoot about whether her father was worshiping idols or not. Well, maybe she cared, but she doesn't think that stealing the idols is going to change his idolatrous heart. That's kind of simplistic, I would think. Option number five, why did she want to steal those idols? John Gill suggests this. She wanted to melt down the gold and silver. So she had an eye to the main chance. She didn't have spiritual motives. She had financial motives. Well, of all those options, I think option two is the right one, that she wanted protection and blessing from those household idols because she still had idolatry in her heart. She hadn't learned yet to get rid of idols. I mean, just think how many Christians you know that have idols in their hearts as they learn to follow the Lord and they learn to not trust in their looks and their intelligence and their social standing and their business standing and their bank account and all that stuff, their fame and all the stuff that we do as worldlings. So we read in verse 20, and Jacob deceived Laban the Aramean by not telling him that he was fleeing. Jacob's still living up to his name. Remember, his name means deceiver. What are some of the times he had deceived before? Well, he tricked Isaac out of his father Isaac's out of his brother Esau's birthright in that famous story. He tricked Laban out of the spotted and speckled sheep, did he not? Trick, trick, trick. Now he's tricking him again, deceiving Laban again by taking off and running by not telling Laban that he was leaving. Now, I don't really blame Jacob for this. I wouldn't tell that old jerk Laban that I was leaving either, because you know what Laban would have done. He would have held him up, made him stay there. Remember, Jacob doesn't have a police force. He doesn't have an armed retinue. He doesn't have bodyguards. He would have been trapped. So I'm not blaming Jacob here for deceiving Laban, just pointing out that he's still living up to his name. So Jacob fled. In verse 21, he rose and crossed the Euphrates River, which by that time Euphrates is running right through Syria there, from southeast to northwest. You cross the Euphrates River, you go a little bit south and west, you hit Damascus around there, you keep going, and the next thing you know, you're at the Sea of Galilee, and you're in the hill country of Gilead. Because Gilead, if you'll look at the map, I've got a good map here from BibleAtlas.org. If you go to the southern tip of the Sea of Galilee and then go to the southeast corner of the Sea of Galilee, that's where the G in Gilead is, and then you go straight south down the Jordan River on the eastern side of the Jordan River, Gilead, and the D ends up right at the northern tip of the Dead Sea. So it's real easy to know where Gilead is. It was a mountainous country right to the east of the Dead Sea. Once you get past the plain of the Jordan, the Araba there, the valley, and the next thing you run into is a ridge of mountains that separates the Syrian desert there, which people would have to cross to get to the Tigris and Euphrates, the Fertile Crescent. But of course, they don't go that way. They go north through Syria and cross the Euphrates and go up through the, on the edge of the mountains up there, the Taurus Mountains. So this is where Jacob is in Gilead. Now, let me give you a few more facts about Gilead from Easton's Illustrated Dictionary. The term means hill of testimony. The reason is because Jacob and Laban are going to make a famous covenant there between themselves, and they give it the name Gilead. It's called the Hill of Testimony, a mountainous region east of Jordan, just like I said. From its mountainous character, it is called the Mount of Gilead sometimes. It's about 60 miles in length and 20 miles in breadth, extending from near the south end of the Lake of Gennesaret, the Sea of Galilee, to the north end of the Dead Sea. That's what I just said. And four of its famous mountains are Abiram, Pisgah, Nebo, and Peor. We will mention Abiram and Peor when we get there. Let me just mention Pisgah and Nebo, because Nebo is where Moses died. So he died in Gilead. Pisgah is the mountain range in which Nebo was a prominent mountain. This is a fertile region southeast of the Sea of Galilee. It was fertile. The name Gilead was actually not named Gilead at the time it was mentioned in this verse, so it's named in anticipation. It's a little anachronistic. In verse 21, Moses says, Jacob set his face toward the hill country of Gilead. Well, it wasn't named Gilead yet, because later, in our next audio, verse 45 through 48, when Laban finally catches up to Jacob, they're going to make a covenant there. Let me go ahead and give you those verses, Genesis 31, 45 through 48. Then Jacob took a stone and set it up as a pillar. Jacob said to his kinsmen, "Gather stones." So they took stones and made a heap, and they ate there by the heap. Now Laban called it Jagar Sahadutha, but Jacob called it Galeed. Laban said, "This heap is a witness between you and me this day." Therefore, it was named Galeed. Now, Galeed is the same as Gilead. I looked that up at Bible.hub's Gilead entry, and an ATS Bible dictionary said Galeed or Gilead. So it's the same thing. The Holman Christian Study Bible note to this verse says that Jagar Sahadutha is Aramaic and Galeed is Hebrew. Both names mean mound of witness. Mound of witness. Or as Easton's translates it, hill of testimony. They made a mound of stones and they witnessed to each other, "Hey, we're not going to fight each other. Jacob and Laban, we are friends now." Uncle Laban and nephew Jacob, I don't know where in this stretch between the southern end of the Sea of Galilee and the northern end of the Dead Sea on the east side of the Jordan River, I don't know where in Gilead that Laban caught up with Jacob. I assume it's in the northern part, and we'll see them when we get there, as we proceed through Genesis. We go now to Genesis 31, verses 22 through 25, and we'll finish up this audio. Verse 22, "When it was told Laban on the third day that Jacob had fled, then he took his kinsmen with him and pursued him a distance of 7 days' journey, and he overtook him in the hill country of Gilead. God came to Laban the Aramean in a dream of the night and said to him, "Be careful that you do not speak to Jacob either good or bad." Laban caught up with Jacob. Now Jacob had pitched his tent in the hill country, and Laban with his kinsmen camped in the hill country of Gilead. Now verse 22 says, Laban on the third day after Jacob had fled. Now why did it take? Well, it took Laban. Jacob had a 3 days head start because Laban had not been told that Jacob had left, and that's probably because Laban's flocks were 3 days from Jacob's. Recall in the previous chapter, Laban had separated his flocks 3 days' journey from Jacob so that they would keep the speckled and spotted sheep away from Jacob. Well, so that they could distinguish Jacob's flocks, the spotted and speckled sheep and goats, from Laban's flocks, which were solid white and solid black, and they separated them 3 days away. And so that's probably how long it took the word to get to Laban, "Hey, your nephew Laban has fled with your two daughters and he's headed out of town." There might have been some more time involved because after he was told, when the message got to him that Jacob had left, he might have returned to his house and found out his idols were stolen, because he really complained about that when he finally caught up with Jacob. So he might have gone home. So it took him a while to get going, probably, and it took him 7 days to catch up. Now, of course, you could say the distance between Laban and Jacob was made up this way. 1/7 of the distance was made up each day for 7 days, and finally he caught up with him. Doesn't really matter. The point is he finally caught up with him, and Jacob had just enough time to get to the edge of the promised land. Now, Jacob fleeing is indicative of a life that has exhibited a pattern of deception and fleeing. Consider how he deceived Esau. What happened? Esau's threatened to kill him, and Rachel says, "We got to get him out of here, Isaac." His mother Rebecca says, "We got to get him out of here, Isaac." And so Jacob heads to Bethel and then on to Haran. Now he's deceived Laban, and he has to flee from Haran. The NIV Study Bible points that out and saying, see there, he's a deceiver, he's fleeing, somehow it's kind of dishonorable. Well, I don't know, this fleeing was God-directed. He had a dream, and the deception was God-directed too. Remember, God endorsed that deception by giving Jacob the speckled flock dream, as we just talked about. So I don't see anything untoward about Jacob fleeing from Laban. I would have fled too, and I wouldn't feel guilty about it. Laban takes his kinsman with him. Who was that? Well, remember, there's a whole family of Abraham. Nahor Sr. lived there. Terah lived there. And Terah had Nahor, who was Abraham's younger brother. And Haran was Abraham's older brother. And Nahor had 7 kids, one of whom was Bethuel. And then, of course, Bethuel had Rebekah and Laban. So there was relatives everywhere up there. Some of them still living, and they went after Jacob. So this was not just a solitary chase. There was a posse coming after Jacob. Now God in this dream told Laban, don't you say anything to Jacob either good or bad. In other words, don't you start promising Jacob to come back to Haran. Don't you say, oh, I'll give you some more spotted and speckled sheep. Look how much money you made with me. Look how many sheep you grew with me. God says, don't you do that. Why? Because God wants Jacob to go back to the promised land. And this is another way where God providentially interferes with the affairs of men. Nobody's free will was violated. Not one, but God providentially worked out what he wanted. He wanted Jacob back in the promised land. He said, don't you say anything bad to Jacob. In other words, don't you threaten to harm Jacob if he goes back to the promised land. You leave him alone. So God intervenes in history here to get what he wants, because he wants a people in the land of promise so that the Messiah can be born to save you and me from our sins. Because God knows what he's doing, and he is sovereign over history. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished Genesis chapter 31, verses 1 through 25. In our next audio, we'll consider verses 26 through 55 and finish up that chapter. And that section of Scripture will deal with Laban's last stand against Jacob. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.